Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a solartopia, solartopia, solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a solartopia all over God's green world?
Well, we bit that apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found.
Oh, yeah.
But don't you know we're gonna have a solartopia?
Too many things. We started to burn too many things. We found that's a Divine Don Williams thing with Pete Seeger and David Burns, the Solartopia song. We got a great show today. We're going to be talking all about the 60s. We're going to be talking about anti-war stories. I got two fabulous guests. Francesco da Vinci, you with us?
Yes, thank you.
How wonderful. And you're in sunny Southern California, I assume.
That's right. Moved from New York and loving it.
Yeah, I don't blame you, man. I have moved there myself, although today I'm in frozen Central Ohio, long way from Central Ohio to Southern California. Steve Spitz, are you with us? Steve is not with us yet. So, Francesco, we will roll right along. You and I,
right,
it turns out, are birth twins. I've never met anybody born on the same day as me, December 31st, 1945. You were born in Washington, D.C., and I was born in Cambridge, Massachusetts. So, what
Amazing.
Time were you born?
Beg your pardon?
What time were you born?
7:55 a.m.
Oh, in the morning. So you beat me. You're well way older than I am, man. You're just an older man. I was born at 4:36 in the afternoon. So what do you know? So, Francesco, you have a fantastic biography here. But tell us about yourself. I always let my guests explain who they are.
Sure.
Do people ask you if you're related to Leonardo, by the way?
Steve is
all the time. All the time,
okay.
But I think we're all related in spirit.
Yes, we are indeed. So Steve Spitz is also joining us from Washington, D.C. Steve, how you doing, buddy?
Hi, how you doing?
Good. You got to speak up. You sound a little distant. You're not on LSD, are you?
Can you hear me?
And we're going to be talking about the 60s, so that's a relevant question. This is for all you 60s buffs out there. Can you speak up?
I can barely hear you.
All right. Well, listen, you're going to see if you have to get a better connection. So maybe call in again. Mm-hmm. You sound distant to us.
Yeah,
okay? Try again. All right. Well, listen, Steve, call in again and yell the next time you're on there because you're a little distant. Francesco da Vinci, tell us about yourself before we take the giant.
Sure. Well, I'm a photojournalist. And I'm producing a documentary film on conscientious objection to war. So it goes not only from the 60s, but it comes up to the present and addresses today's divided America.
Wow.
Are you there?
We're trying
to promote diversity and nonviolence.
Well, those are two admirable qualities. Tell us how you got into this, because I know a bit about you now. But tell us
it was very reluctant that I became an activist. It wasn't like I had a burning desire to make a contribution. I had a couple of wake-up calls. I was raised with wealthy parents. They were millionaires in the suburbs of Northern Virginia. So I was totally oblivious, and it was a segregated neighborhood. I was oblivious to issues. So it started coming in through TV, and then my parents had the opportunity to travel around the world, and they brought my brother and I on a couple trips on cruises, and for the first time I saw starvation. That was the first wake-up call for me. And then the civil rights movement started coming from the 50s to the 60s into our living rooms through television, and that was another wake-up call because I had assumed everything was just perfect with America, the country I loved. and I didn't realize the serious problems of racism that existed. I don't even remember seeing a African-American student in my high school for 4 years. And my high school was named J.E.B. Stewart after some generals, you know. So currently now they're trying to rename the school Thurgood Marshall or something
Steve
else.
Steve is back on.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah. Hi, Steve. Are you there?
Yes, I'm here. And
I'm talking about my upbringing in the D.C. area that you know well. And the other wake-up call for me was the draft. And it forced me to take responsibility. My best buddy was serving in Vietnam, and I thought, how hypocritical that I'm on a student deferment, he's in Vietnam, standing up for his beliefs. So in 1968, I finally applied as a conscientious objector to war. So like I said, it was a reluctant activism.
And what happened with you, and your CO?
Well, you know, one of the things about the draft that's unfair is the geographical area that you're from is a big factor in whether or not you're recognized. For example, I was raised in the pro-war state of Virginia, and that you keep that draft board your whole life. And if you're in San Francisco, it's a totally different atmosphere and a total different response to the idea of conscientious objection. And for your listeners who are not familiar with conscientious objection, it's basically, you know, somebody who refuses to kill because of their conscience. And it's supposed to be open whether you belong to an organized religion or it's your personal spiritual beliefs, either way. But that's basically what a CO was. And Virginia was a rough state. I mean, I don't know if anyone has ever seen our state flag, but it has a circle emblem with a soldier with its foot on the chest of a dead soldier. So it was a rough atmosphere for civil rights and for taking a stand for peace.
But you did it. So what happened to you during the Vietnam War?
Well, I faced I became a prominent activist, and then my prison time kept going up that I faced. I refused induction in L.A. in 1969, and then when I became a prominent activist, the draft lawyer said, now you're more than likely facing 5 years in prison, the maximum. And so I went. I was on appeal for 3 years, and I was getting ready for prison, and my girlfriend was going to move to the prison area, and I told all my family and relatives that I wouldn't be seeing them for a while. And then on the very last appeal, the state director of selective service overturned in my favor. And it turned out, years later, I found out who this guy was, and he was the first African-American in the entire draft system. And they were trying to show that they were finally integrating in 1971 the system, and I happened to get him. And by a tremendous act of courage on his part, his name was Ernest Fears Jr., to pay tribute to him now. He's passed away, but I still honor him. Tremendous courage. He went against the Nixon administration, and he went against his own system, the draft board, who had rejected my claim twice, and he overturned and said, you got it wrong. This guy is a sincere, conscientious objector.
So did you have to do any service as part of your conscientious objector?
Yes. You, a lot of people don't realize you actually serve, but if it's outside the military, it's called alternative service, and I was a director of a community center in San Diego in a barrio for 2 years.
Wow. Stephen Smith, you know, the three of us are all about the same age. Francesco and I are exactly the same age, and Steve, you're a year younger. What did you do during the Vietnam draft?
Okay. Well, first of all, thanks, Harvey. I did want to say something to what I heard when I just got on the call, and that is, the name of the high school, Jeb Stuart High School, has been changed. The new name is Justice High School in honor of Justice Thurgood Marshall and others, and that takes effect this July.
Wonderful.
Wow, congratulations.
And that's where I went to high school.
Right, right. Your high school.
And Julianne Moore, the actress, I believe, isn't she from there also?
Yes, and Bruce Cohen, who was the Academy Award-winning producer for the movie American Beauty. Bruce also went there, and Bruce and Julianne started a petition that got a whole lot of signatures to change the name.
But anyway, that has happened. And just today, you should know, this is breaking news, Harvey, that the students have selected a new name. And instead of the Jeb Stuart Raiders, the school will be known as the Justice Wolves.
Wolves, like the animal?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, cool.
Like Dances with Wolves, yeah.
All right. So
that's a student-selected name. They did a vote, and that's what the students picked.
Wow. So, Steve, what did you do with the Vietnam War in the draft?
Okay, well, Harvey, as we've discussed, when I was a freshman at the University of Michigan, I read this book called The Vietnam Reader that was edited by Marcus Raskin and Bernard Fall, and it was a compilation of a bunch of short pieces about the Vietnam, what Vietnam was, political speeches, the portions of the Geneva Accords, et cetera. And I went to the first teach-in that Harvey, you also went to, which was in Ann Arbor at the University of Michigan in March of 1965.
Right.
So by the time I was a senior, which was 1968, I was totally committed to no way was I going to go to Vietnam. I read all the stuff about conscientious objection, and I actually remember seeing in Ann Arbor David Harris talk about his draft resisting, and I decided two things in terms of my own personal thing. It was that if I resisted the draft, I wanted to be a lawyer, which I became. That wouldn't be a good recommendation before the character committee to be a member of the bar, so I decided not to do that. And I also decided that I couldn't honestly say that I was a conscientious objector. So I learned the draft law. I got a succession of legitimate deferments. And then eventually I did a lot of draft counseling when I was, before I was a lawyer and when I was in law school, and actually knew the draft law and its ever-changing idiosyncrasies. And I participated in the anti-war movement. I regard myself as a veteran of the anti-war, anti-Vietnam War movement. Was I at the Chicago Convention in 1968, got tear gassed, participated in I don't know how many demonstrations, a lot, it seemed, and basically opposed that war. And I remember when I first came to Washington, D.C. as a lawyer in 1973, I remember watching the debate in the Senate to end the funding, which was eventually ended for that war. But that occupied, I would say, as Tom Hayden put it, the draft was not a issue, it was the issue that was occupying our minds, our consciences, our actions, and everything. For example, one of the things I did, which was just to get through the summer of 68, is I found out, I knew enough about the draft law that the deferment lasted for four full years, not just four academic years. So I saw one of my professors had a button, a McCarthy button, and I said to him, so what would happen if I didn't show up to the final? And I think he knew what I was talking about. He said, well, write me a note and say for personal reasons you didn't show up at the final, and I'll give you an incomplete, let you make it up over the summer. So I did, and what that did effectively is made sure I didn't graduate until August. So I had my full years. Then I got a teaching diploma, teaching in the Chicago Public Schools for the 68-69 school years. That was a deferment. I didn't go to law school. I was supposed to start in 68, but, you know, it wasn't deferrable. And I also had to turn down an offer in a PhD program at Berkeley. It was a nice political science PhD, national defense scholarship, but I couldn't do that because I wouldn't be teaching until my second year. My plan was to get a master's in political science and decide whether I wanted to go to law school, and I had also gotten into Berkeley Law School. Or
right,
go on for
Steve, you and I shared a lot of history at the University of Michigan, and Francesco and I share a birthday. Francesco is also in Southern California. You have a Francesco da Vinci. You have a program this Saturday, January 20th, at the Santa Monica Library.
Oh, thank you for mentioning that.
Santa Monica Boulevard. You're making a film called I Refuse to Kill. Can you tell us about this film?
Oh, thank you very much. Yeah, it's this Saturday from 2 to 3 at the Santa Monica Public Library, and it's free. The idea is to tell not just my personal story, and we go through the entire 60s decade, but it's also to honor all the conscientious objectors throughout history. The popular myth is that conscientious objectors are draft dodgers, and in fact, the opposite is true. Because when they got the draft notices, and if they were not recognized, they could have gone to Canada, and they could have faked their way out of the draft with a legal deferment, but they willingly went to prison. That's what Muhammad Ali did. And as you know, they took away his heavyweight title unjustly just because of his politics. So the purpose of the film, I Refuse to Kill, is to honor these conscientious objectors who made tremendous, tremendous sacrifice to take a stand and champion nonviolence. And it wasn't just them that, that were affected. The families paid a terrible price. And, you know, if you look at the history of COs, which should be in our history books and is not, you know, Steve mentioned Jeb Stuart High School, you know, a new consciousness there. The change is coming. It's a new consciousness to honor these people. They're not in our history books, and they should be. They did tremendous. They were patriots. They were brave. And if I may, I'd like to honor my draft attorneys. You know, Steve did some draft counseling. At the time, there were thousands of draft counselors, lawyers, who were donating their time for free just to help these people through the legal process. So on Saturday, we're going to show a clip from the film, I Refuse to Kill. It's in progress. There are 20 celebrities in the film already, including President Carter and the actor Richard Dreyfuss, who was a conscientious objector. And then we're going to do a PowerPoint presentation, thank you, of the photos that I took throughout the 60s and the major marches and the iconic figures of the 60s.
So were you a professional photographer? In the 60s,
no, but since the age of 9, I never put a camera down. In a way, it was kind of like my creative freedom. And so I documented the entire decade from I was as a kid. I attended President Kennedy's inauguration on January 20th. In fact, today is the day, inauguration day, exactly. And that was 1961 in Washington, D.C., and I photographed President and Jacqueline going by in their car. And when my buddy and I yelled to JFK, he was kind enough to pick up his top hat and wave it to us. We never forgot it. And then it goes through the entire decade, which I call America's Second Revolution, and it ends with Neil Armstrong's famous walk on the moon. And by just fate, I happened to meet Neil Armstrong was my hero. And I met him on the set of a Bob Hope show. I was Bob's photographer in the 80s. And we became lifelong friends. Over 20 years, we were in correspondence with each other. So it goes all the way to 1969 when we walked on the moon, on that historic day, July 20th, 1969.
So you went from the moonwalk of Neil Armstrong to the moonwalk of Michael Jackson. Did you ever photograph Michael Jackson?
I met Michael, but I never photographed him.
I mean,
he was wearing a red military jacket. Genius performer.
Your website. What is your website? Because people listening.
Thank you very much. It's Francesco.
So go to your website. While you listen, I've been looking through.
The number
one. Some amazing photographs.
And everybody's welcome to
Francesco da Vinci. Tell us some of the people that you photographed here.
Well, five presidents. And Neil Armstrong was my hero. That was my favorite favorite photo shoot. The Dalai Lama, world leaders, musicians like David Bowie, great experience. People entertainment, great athletes. Muhammad Ali, one of my favorite, three times with photographing Muhammad Ali. And he, I'm honored to say he's in our film also.
How long is the film going to be?
It's going to be 90 minutes. I completed a book recently, and then we're going to submit that, same title. Documentaries in production, we're about a third of the way through. And people like, you know, incredible John Glenn is in the film. And then we're going to go for feature film because there's never been a feature film conscientious about a conscientious objector to the Vietnam War who goes through all the 60s. It's kind of like a true Forrest Gump story. But in addition to the personal story, again, we're going to honor conscientious objectors throughout history.
That's fantastic.
Well, thank you.
Da Vinci. So are you the CO? Are you at the center of this film?
Yes, it's a drama romance, and it's a big part of the story is how I drove my fiance crazy.
Is she still with you?
You know, it was a big strain because nobody thought this was a sane idea to apply as a conscientious objector. I mean, you know, you do that, you give up your student deferment, and I ended up facing 5 years in prison. And my dad, ironically, was a psychiatrist. And he said, I wanted you to get out with a fake psychiatric, but now I think you really deserve one.
That's amazing. Well, I will disclose to you, Steve and Francesco, that I had student deferment, and then I taught school, and then I threw in my deferment. And by the time they got me to take a physical, I was 23, and I came into the physical place at Fort Hays here in Columbus, Ohio. I don't think I could have gotten away with this on the coast in Boston or New York or L.A., but I went into my physical on LSD, and they take one look at me, you know, and say, well, this guy's 23. He's clearly out of his mind, and that was it. So that was my experience.
Well,
with,
many people
with the draft.
Gave great performances
but, I certainly
for their draft
COs. And I think we had a definite impact. Steve Spitz, you were active. You and I were both at the Chicago Convention, and we were in Haven Hall in 1965 during the Vietnam teach-in at the University of Michigan. And I told you recently, I'll tell Francesco and our listeners, I had an amazing experience. And we're just here this hour talking about, you know, 60s experiences. So I was I started the University of Michigan in the fall of 63. And then in March of 65, the story was that there were a bunch of professors, and they wanted to go on strike against the war, and they wanted to not teach. And the university sort of gently suggested that might not be a good idea. So they did the opposite. What they did was they said, okay, give us Haven Hall. We'll start at midnight so that we don't conflict with any other classes, and we'll teach all night about the war in Vietnam.
Wow.
And so I went there, and Steve went there, and there was a packed house.
Yeah.
And it was really a fantastic experience. And then, amazingly enough, last year, I guess it's, 3 years ago now, they came to me, Julia Herrera, who runs the Labadie Collection at the University of Michigan, asked me to come speak, and they did another teach-in in Haven Hall on global warming, and they asked me to speak. And so I was able to get up in this front of this crowd. It was a packed house at Haven Hall where they had the original Vietnam teach-ins, and to say, look, 50 years ago, I was a sophomore in this room, and I asked if there were any sophomores in this room. There was one. And basically I said, look, if you're crazy enough to stick with some issue, mine was, of course, nuclear power and solar energy for the next 50 years, you can wind up like me giving a speech here where they had to teach him, and you can say that you were in this hall 50 years ago. It turns out I was the only one to speak who had been a student during the teach-ins. They had four faculty members who had been at the teach-ins at the U of M in 1965. It was amazing. These guys, you know, they were in their 80s and 90s. There were four of them. But I was doing, and I got to speak with Tom Hayden and Amy Goodman. It was really a great thing and a great honor. Of course, we made a tremendous impact. Steve, you were also with me at the Chicago Convention in 1968,
yes.
And we just talked about this. And Francesco, were you at the convention in Chicago?
No, but I was working for Bobby Kennedy, and my fiance was working for Eugene McCarthy.
Oh, cool. So,
and if I could just mention a symbolic
Bobby Kennedy
moment
died
of the times, and then
before the
real quick, I spent symbolic of the times. I spent my graduation day, instead of getting my diploma, I was at Bobby Kennedy's funeral.
And, oh God!
It was a
Where did you
dark
go to school?
Period, as you know, Martin Luther King was assassinated only a few months before, in April, and in June, and I had met Bobby 1 month before he was assassinated. And telling him how much his candidacy meant to me and the country. And then I ended up, instead of getting my diploma, it fell on the same day as my graduation, and I went to Arlington National Cemetery instead to honor him.
Well, of course, yes, Steve.
Yeah, I just wanted to say a couple things about the teach-in. First of all, my understanding is that these professors, and it's important to note to everybody, that professors, not students, started this idea, which is, I think,
right.
fascinating, that they went to the president of the university, who at the time was Harlan Hatcher. And Hatcher was horrified by the notion that there would be canceled classes and they would teach about Vietnam instead. He said, you can have these buildings all night if you want, thinking that nobody would show up, of course. But there were curious people who... by the way, we're used to staying up late at night, like me and
right.
Harvey, and we wanted to see what was going on. And what happened afterwards was absolutely extraordinary. Within weeks of the University of Michigan teach-in, there were hundreds of these teach-ins all around the country, and it started this whole new, essentially, method of learning called teach-ins. So when I was an undergraduate at the University of Michigan, I went to teach-ins at the university on a whole host of subjects. But there was one I remember on China, where some guy named Felix Green had gotten in during the Cultural Revolution, filming what was going on actually in China, and very few people knew about this. There was a drug teach-in that I first learned about the legendary John Sinclair getting 10 years in maximum security prison for giving away two joints to an undercover agent and was later freed after a rally by the Michigan Supreme Court declaring his sentence was cruel and unusual punishment after a big rally where John Lennon and Yoko Ono composed the song Free John, Free John. There were also teach-ins on other subjects, and this became, I guess, what was different about it. There was a lot. It wasn't just a professor lecturing at students. It was kind of people expressing their views. You know, multimedia, a professor could say something, a student can say something. It was more of a kind of thing you would do in the dorm, like a bull session, rather than just the sort of a formal teaching device. And it sort of also, I think, developed ideas into what a curriculum should look like in a university. When I was a senior at Michigan, I was on the curriculum committee for the College of Literature, Science, and the Arts. By that time, they figured, because we had been agitating enough, they would have a student on the committee. So I was on this committee, and we were thinking about, well, what if we had, instead of these siloed departments, what if we had interdisciplinary courses where it didn't matter what department was? And what if, say, there was a graduate student, like maybe one of you guys, who knew the history of the blues and could do a curriculum on the blues? Why should we have to have that course taught by a university professor? If the students wanted to learn that, they should be able to take that course, provided there was substance to it, et cetera. And I found out, 4 years later, when I came back to teach in the law school at the University of Michigan, that there were all sorts of law students teaching undergraduates things like school law and street law and environmental law and so on. And this had developed a significant expansion of the idea of what a what a course could be and what a curriculum was like. So this thing really spurred a lot of things in a lot of directions. And, of course, the thing it did most was awaken the entire generation to what was going on in Vietnam.
Yeah, and you have to remember, this was March of 1965. This is actually when Lyndon Johnson escalated the war. I mean, he had just been given a term because he defeated Barry Goldwater. And, you know, he had promised during the campaign that I'm not going to try and do his Texas accent, but he promised he would not send our boys 8,000 miles away to die in some jungle. And, of course, that's exactly what he did. And it was quite prescient of the professors at the University of Michigan to in 1965 to understand how important this all really was. And so, you know, we were present at the creation. Francesco, you said that you missed your college graduation. Where were you in college?
University of Maryland, College Park. So I was at the center of a lot of that activity. And I attended the 1964 Democratic Convention. And I had been hoping that Bobby Kennedy would announce and run, but he felt it was too early. And I remember Barbra Streisand and Peter, Paul, and Mary performed. And the music was a big factor also inspiring our generation to activism, don't you think?
Well, yeah, and you you have a preface to your book by Peter Yarrow of Peter, Paul, and Mary. I have met him. And they of course, had a big role in singing Puff the Magic Dragon, which allegedly was about cannabis. And, you know, Where Have All the Flowers Gone?
Blowing in the Wind.
Pete Seeger's song, is that right?
Yes, but what I mean is they popularized it, too.
Yeah. And I don't think they sang Turn, Turn, Turn. That was the Byrds, but that was also a Pete Seeger song. So you were talking about Bobby Kennedy and, you know, what a horrible tragedy it was that we lost him. But we still have his son, Bobby Kennedy Jr., who lives in L.A. now and is still very active on issues having to do with the environment, especially.
Harvey, if I can, on the music thing, I think we would be remiss if we didn't mention who I revere the most in terms of an anti-war singer, and that was Phil Oakes. Phil Oakes was really iconic. I mean, Phil Oakes, with his songs like I Ain't Marching Anymore and Draft Dodger's Rag, just a personal connection. At the 68 convention, I drove Phil Oakes from this concert they had back to his hotel. And also when I was back in Ann Arbor in 72, he did a benefit concert for McGovern's campaign at the University of Michigan. And I was with him then. And sadly, he was no longer with us about 1976 when he took his life. But he was at every anti-war thing. He was at that thing, that Free John Sinclair rally. I heard him in Ann Arbor and Chicago and all sorts of places. And he was kind of the troubadour of the anti-war movement, I think.
Well, Phil Oakes was actually from Marion, Ohio, a Jewish family that in Marion, Ohio, where they may have been the only Jewish family. And I went up to Marion a while ago for something to do with agriculture. And I talked to a woman who runs the museum in Marion, Ohio, and she had never heard of Phil Oakes. It completely blew my mind. And, you know, I had to explain to her who he was. And meanwhile, he was just such a powerful figure in the anti-war movement. He was a friend of Bob Dylan's, and Dylan kind of went in a different direction than Phil Oakes. But you mentioned driving him from the rally at the Chicago Convention in 1968. I was in the audience at that rally, and it was when he sang, and I've talked about this many times over the years. This was during the Chicago Convention. This was in a hall in Chicago where Woodrow Wilson was nominated for president in 1916. So this was a really old hall. And so when Phil Oakes sang "I Ain't Marching Anymore," I have never been in a more electric moment. And everybody in the, you know, this was 1968, for God's sakes, and the city was going crazy. And Phil Oakes sings this song, and people went completely crazy. And everybody in that hall burned either a draft card or a dollar bill. I had already burned my draft card, so I had to burn a dollar bill. But it was absolutely fantastic. And, you know, I wish the guy that Phil Oakes was still with us.
Yeah, I think I read biographies of Phil Oakes, and I actually saw there was a movie about his life that came out.
Oh, yeah, I saw it. It's very good, actually.
Yeah, and what my view is, I mean, he obviously had his own emotional problems. But one of them was that after the war was over, he kind of lost his purpose. You know, he no longer was, you know, the anti-war troubadour because there was no more war. And he tried, actually, at one point, I don't know if you guys recall, he was trying sort of gold lamé jackets to be sort of an Elvis Presley, and that was not him, obviously.
No, that was not him. But
yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead. Francesco, were you going to jump in?
I was saying
that it was very tragic that he died in 1976.
Yeah, well, I had the good fortune to be living on a communal farm. We got there in 68, and when the war ended in 75, at that time, we had been gifted an issue that I'm still with, which is the nuclear power. The local utility company had come into our town in 1973 and said they were going to build a nuclear plant. And we were thrilled. You know, I mean, just we knew that, you know, my whole life flashed before me when they said that. So it's too bad Phil wasn't at the commune with us. He could have been the troubadour for the anti-nuclear movement. We're talking here with Steve Spitz and Francesco Da Vinci. These are two great activists dating back to the 1960s. Francesco has a film showing coming up this Saturday in Santa Monica at the library there. Francesco, tell us a bit more about your film. What is the basic structure of it? And you got 90 minutes. What are you going to fill it with?
Well, so far, I'm proud to say that over 20 celebrities have participated with on-camera interviews. So, for example, there was a female conscientious objector. She was military intelligence for the Iraq War and then changed her mind and thought, this is wrong and my conscience really doesn't allow this. And, you know, took a lot of courage. And then her own family was very disapproving. And she said that her father told her, this is going to be a black mark on you forever. So, you know, it takes a lot of courage to take that stand. And, you know, one of the things that people forget about the 60s, in the beginning of the Vietnam War, there's a tendency just to be on board, you know, not to question. And if you do question, you're a suspect. It's like they question your patriotism. In the case of COs, they're branded as cowardly, you know, or shirking their duty, not patriotic, draft dodger, all those labels. I remember in our classes at the University of Maryland, you know, Steve mentioned the teach-ins, and there were also the workshops. There was a tremendous amount of hostility and hatred in the beginning, and you would get heckled for taking. I remember in a class of over 100, I was the only one that raised the hand for immediate withdrawal from Vietnam, that we didn't have business there, and the government themselves, the people of Vietnam, didn't really want the help. So, you know, to put it in context again, change comes slowly. The joke about it is, you know, in the beginning, change is seen as impossible, and then when it comes, people look at it as inevitable. But gradually, the tide changed, and then the majority became against the war and insisted on a withdrawal from Vietnam.
Yeah, you know, there's this moment, as a journalist, I know this well, when you break a story and nobody wants to pay attention to you and they question your credibility, and then the moment passes and they start to tell you, oh, that's old news. So who are some of the people in your film that you'd most like to mention?
Well, first of all, I guess it would be President Carter. When I asked him, I said, you know, he was the one who granted amnesty, I believe, 1977. And I asked him, I said, you know, I told him I was a conscientious objector. And I never realized that he told me that his son Jack served in Vietnam. I never knew that. And he granted amnesty, and I said, why'd you do it? And he said, I wanted to heal the country. And then
well, that Richard was better Dreyfuss, than pardoning Nixon, that's for sure.
Yeah, yeah. Let's see. And then there, like I mentioned, California, Senator John Glenn took a approach of reconciliation also, and he said, even though he may have disagreed with some of the COs, he definitely had the feeling that the vast majority were sincere in their convictions. So people like that, and we honor Rosa Parks, who I photographed December 1st, 1945. You know, she refused to go to the back of the bus, and then a young unknown preacher came in to support the movement, Dr. King, in Montgomery, and that was one of the influences. And then Dr. King was brave enough to expand from the civil rights activism to call for an end to the war, and he also suffered tremendous hatred, as you remember, at the time. And it's
Yep, he did.
So
that's right.
Those are
I actually met Martin Luther King in Grenada, Mississippi, on the Meredith Civil Rights March in the summer of 1966, between my sophomore, maybe between my junior and senior year. And he was a really just a very nice guy. And you know, I heard him speak in a small church in Grenada, Mississippi. It was quite an experience. Who else was in your film?
Well, one thing I wanted to mention before I list people in the film is that for today, you know, today's generation, I'm hoping there's going to be a resurgence of these ideals that we seem to be drifting from, especially concerning civil rights and openness. You know, I spoke at all the UC campuses, and in Berkeley, we were campaigning for the free speech movement. Mario Savio really started that. And people don't realize that many of the universities, if not most, would not even allow political tables to be set up. So it was very repressive. And then it gradually opened up. And I would just like to encourage today's generation for a resurgence of the ideals we're drifting from, especially concerning civil rights. And you know, I think we've got to listen to each other. This is a time of a divided America. It was even more divided in the 60s, as you know. But this is a time to come back together for civil rights and for nonviolent activism instead of going to war so readily. And they say that about 3%, only 3% of our military budget would take care of hunger around the world. So, you know, we desperately need some new priorities, too, and I would encourage your listeners, don't feel hopeless about things, even though it's very divided and there's a lot of hateful rhetoric out there. I would say we can all do something in our own microcosm. And when I started a peace group in San Diego, one of the most military towns in the world, I worked with soldiers that were disillusioned with the war. A lot of people feel that peace activists were anti-soldier, which is not the case in the vast majority of the situations, and especially in the 60s. We worked together. So we formed a peace group called Nonviolent Action, and it grew into a national movement. And Tom Hayden and Joan Baez's husband, David Harris, showed their support and came to aid the group. And Joan Baez raised the money with benefit concerts. And we started with three people, and it grew to 300 people. So I guess for your listeners, I'm saying you never know. It's like ripples on the water. We can all do something in our microcosm. Don't give give up. That's I guess that's a message I'd like to reiterate.
Well, Steve,
Harvey,
you and
if I could say something on that,
please.
This is Stephen. I am right now near the Senate, U.S. Senate on Capitol Hill, and I was there lobbying on DACA, on the Dream Act. And what I witnessed there was something incredible, and that is these young dreamers all over the place acting like we all did in the 60s, being strong and brave and asserting their rights. And it was really encouraging to see that these young people were, you know, had the courage to go out throughout the Senate today. We don't know what's going to happen by tomorrow. This is a very tense moment because we don't know how many of the senators are going to hold out to include the Dream Act in the budget. And what we should know whether or not this is going to happen tomorrow, because Democratic senators are now the ones who just kicked the can down the road in December. Several of them have announced that they are not going to tolerate a budget that doesn't include the Dream Act, that doesn't include the CHIP, Child Health Program, et cetera. And they're getting buttressed by these young people who are swarming around the Senate today demanding that they get the Dream Act included in this budget. So we'll see what happens, but I do sense that also I was involved with Bernie Sanders. I was a delegate to the Democratic National Convention for Bernie in Philadelphia in 2016. And, you know, people who are young were inspired by a lot of what Bernie was saying. And they're, I think this active generation is going to equal or surpass the 60s generation, in my view.
Well, I hope so.
I think they're getting very motivated.
They sure got their work cut out for them. And you and I met recently, Stephen, and this is a story I tell whenever I possibly can. You know, we who marched against the war in Vietnam, and I was involved with the anti-war movement from start to finish, from 65 in Ann Arbor, where you really couldn't avoid it until 75. And, you know, we're always told that we didn't have an impact, and nothing we did made any difference. And then I was reading a book, and I don't remember the book, actually, but it said somewhere that Daniel Ellsberg, who was a pro-war expert, had been, met with Richard Nixon before Ellsberg turned, and then Nixon had told him that he wanted to use nuclear weapons in Vietnam, but he couldn't do it because of the anti-war movement. And
That has come up many times.
Yes. And I carried that story in my head for years. And I actually got arrested with Dan Ellsberg in 1980 at the Pentagon. And so a couple years ago, I was in Berkeley, and I made a point of inviting Dan to lunch. And I said, Dan, did Richard Nixon tell you in the Oval Office that if it hadn't been for the people marching against the war in Vietnam, he would have used nuclear weapons there? And Dan Ellsberg said, absolutely true. That definitely happened. So anybody who's ever going to be an activist, first of all, everybody who marched against the war in Vietnam, there you have it. And if you're ever going to be an activist and you don't think you're making an impact, don't believe it, because activism is the only thing that saves this planet. And I mean, when we got involved in the... Yes.
Harvey, there's another story involving Daniel Ellsberg along those lines, which was really incredible. I was at a basement of a church in 1986, where it was sort of a planning meeting of a demonstration in front of the CIA concerning the Contras, the troops that were in Nicaragua against the Sandinistas that were illegally funded through Oliver North, through the proceeds of the arms sales to Iran. Any rate, there was David Dellinger talking about conscientious objectors. This gentleman was a conscientious objector to World War II. And David Dellinger, who was one of the Chicago Seven defendants, who I witnessed both the trial. And I was in law school at the time in Chicago when that was going on. Dellinger is telling the story of the March on the Pentagon in 1967. And he was saying, even though there was, you know, all that many of us, and even though people thought, well, what's the sense of doing this? there was at least one guy who was looking out the window at the time in the Pentagon, looking at us. And as he's speaking, this guy is standing next to him, sort of smiling, and it's Daniel Ellsberg. Ellsberg was literally looking at the windows of the Pentagon and was affected by that march. And, you know, his point is you never know what your impact can be if you do stuff like that. You know for certain what your impact if you don't.
Right.
If you don't stand up,
can I add something about Ellsberg?
If you don't stand
Ellsberg,
up, nothing will ever happen. If you do, you never know.
Yes.
True.
Francesco, you want to
like
throw
ripples
something
on
in
the
here?
Water. Last week, I went to a talk by Daniel Ellsberg. His new book is Doomsday Machine, about the dangers of nuclear war. And one of the things that I was shocked to hear from him, I never knew this, as a conscientious objector, I asked him, and I said, when he talked about the nuclear war scenarios, what about all the conscientious objectors who willingly went to prison by the thousands for conscience and for nonviolence? And he turned and said, there would never have been the release of the Pentagon Papers without conscientious objectors. I was inspired by them, and it caused me to do what I did. And
wow.
I had never heard that before. And he heard the testimony of a conscientious objector who said, I'm heading to prison now, and I'm looking forward to joining my conscientious objector friends to do the right thing. And he said he went to the men's room and he cried. He was so moved. And that moment, he decided he definitely had a duty to release the Pentagon Papers.
Well, that's amazing, and I'm not surprised. I got arrested with him, as I said, at the Pentagon in 1980. Our affinity group included Daniel Berrigan and Dr. Benjamin Spock, so we had a lot of fun. It was my first arrest, and I always thought it was great that I was getting arrested with the guy who wrote the book on how my mother raised me. So there you go. Francesco, tell us a bit more about your film.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
We're looking for the film director, Dan Lowenthal in New York, has signed on for the film. Now we're looking for a major producer and going. We want to go to feature film after the doc to highlight this issue and pay tribute to the nonviolent activists. And I'd like to – two things I'd like to mention real quick, and I thank you very much for this opportunity, Harvey. I'm very grateful. Number one –
Well, listen, one thing, both you guys – from now on, you're going to have to call me Sluggo. I have reverted back to my hippie name.
Got it.
And so call me
thing,
Sluggo. And go ahead.
Well, Sluggo, today is I photographed the Apollo 11 crew, Neil Armstrong's crew.
Strong.
And today is Buzz Aldrin's birthday. He's 87 years old today. So happy birthday,
wow.
Buzz. The second one, I'd like to just quote Dr. King, who said, we must learn to live together as brothers, and I'm going to add in sisters, or perish together as fools.
Absolutely. I do want to mention real quickly, tomorrow, on Monday, I'll be flying back to California from Columbus, and I'll be flying out of the John Glenn International Airport. They renamed it after him, and I'm very happy about that. He was a great guy, and I worked for many years with a guy named Robert Alvarez, co-authored a book with him, and Bob was John Glenn's assistant or aide while he was a senator on issues having to do with nuclear power and radioactive waste. And John Glenn was a tremendous asset to the people who were trying out to find out the truth about atomic weapons and the production of them in the United States. We're running out of time. Francesco, how can people get a hold of you and
give you the website. It's francescoproductions1.com. Would love to hear from anybody, and I thank you, Sluggo, for this opportunity.
There you go. And Steve Smith, how can people get a hold of you and with your latest activities?
I'll give you my email address. It's K as in kite, C as in cat, N as in Nancy, S as in Sam, P as in Peter, ITZ. That's kcnspitz@aol.com.
Okay, so we have just a couple more minutes. We'll let the crew in New York swing in with the music when they're tired of hearing us talk. But I got to say that, Steve, you mentioned the Bernie people and the young people today being more radical than us. I think that they actually, they will be. I think we can take some credit for laying down some lessons, especially the acceptance of nonviolence. You know, at the beginning of the anti-war movement, there are a lot of questions about nonviolence, but I think thanks in large part to Dr. King and to the influence of the Quakers, it stuck. We'll talk about it next week. Thank you, guys. See you in the 60s.
Did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down.